Save big on your next project right now at Menards. From mold and mildew stains and hard-to-stick surfaces, preparing your paint project has never been easier than with Bullseye 123. Zinsser Bullseye 123 Primer is an all-purpose, high-performance, water-based primer for interior and exterior residential, commercial, and industrial applications. Save big on Bullseye 123 Primer. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Shop with Rakuten and you'll get it. What's it? It's the best deal, the highest cash back, the most savings on your shopping. So join Rakuten and start getting cash back at Nike, Expedia, Bloomingdale's, and other stores you love. You can even stack sales on top of cash back. Just start your shopping with Rakuten to save money at over 3,500 stores. Join for free at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
Yes, you can email the show alive and kicking at newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, author and journalist Caroline Williams on introception and why you should never ignore your body's signals. Dr. Larissa Korda on bringing complementary practices into her medical qualifications to help with fertility on a physical, mental and spiritual way. And performance nutritionist Daniel Davey on how everyone has the ability to live the life of an athlete. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Another good week? I mean, look, Ronan Keating was right when he said life is a roller coaster and who knows when a white knuckle turn is coming. But I am good at the moment. I'm smiling. Sure, why wouldn't I be? I'm just back from a week in sunny Spain with my family. I would spend mornings before anyone else got up on the rooftop terrace of our little Airbnb writing my book and then we'd all head off to get breakfast and chill out at the beach for the day. So, you know, this is good stuff. I know I've spoken about it on the show before, but because the first decade of us as parents having kids shot by, this one we're making sure that we are as present as possible and to take as many opportunities to connect as a family as we can. I do feel very lucky that we got to go away. You don't necessarily have to step into a different country or onto a plane to have that connection. But look, we had a great week and the sun added to it. It was also my birthday while we were there on Monday. So it was lovely to be somewhere very different and have a dip in the Mediterranean. So I am counting my blessings along with the years. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Caroline Williams is a writer dealing mainly with health, neuroscience and nature-based topics. A regular with the New Scientist magazine, she's also the author of two books, Move and Override. Her latest book, Inner Sense, explores the topic of introception, how our bodies tell our brains what we're feeling and how a greater understanding and harnessing of this can transform our health. And Caroline Williams joins me on the line now. Caroline, you're very welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Tell me what drew you to this topic.
Well, I've been a science journalist now for 25 years and a lot of that time I've been fascinated by the mind and why we think the way we do, why we feel the way we do and sort of all the glitches that come as part of being a human. And for a lot of that time, most of the science was about what goes on in the head, in the brain. And then I just noticed over the years that there started to be a bit of a change towards things that are happening in the body and how signals from within the body play into how we think, how we feel, and in fact are completely fundamental to how we think and how we feel. And interoception, as it turns out, is a massive thing in science that almost nobody knows about.
So can you explain it to us?
Yes. It's one of those words that sounds like it was made up by accountants or something. It doesn't do a very good job at getting across just how exciting and interesting it really is. So introception is a catch-all term that describes the way we perceive and interpret signals from inside the body. So that's everything from the heartbeat to whether you're hungry, whether you need to pee. And there are sort of three levels of these signals. There's the ones that you will never feel, so we essentially don't need to worry about them. Like you can never think, oh, I think I'll tune into my kidneys today and see how that's going. Then there are the ones that we can feel, like the heartbeat and how hungry we are and, you know, how full the bladder is, which are, you can tune in if you want to a certain extent, but they will let you know, they will let you know if there's something important that needs to be done or to be noticed. And then there's sort of the intermediate ones that are kind of what we think of as gut feelings and intuition and sort of these sort of spidey senses, where background feelings sort of are there all the time, play into how we think and feel without ways of, without just really being able to put our finger on why. So, for example, whether we feel comfortable and confident, or whether we feel low on energy, or whether we feel you know, ready to go, or whether we feel enthusiastic. So all of these are sort of based on sensations that arise in the body and their conversations back and forth with the brain.
And sometimes that idea of the gut-brain connection, even though it's getting a lot more coverage now, it can seem a little bit woo-woo, but I think anyone who's ever felt nervous or excited and been thinking that in their head and then felt butterflies in their tummy, we have felt that connection, but perhaps we didn't know that's what was going on.
Absolutely. And it's something that about, I would say, 10, 15 years ago, researchers started saying. So one of the key researchers in this area is Sarah Garfinkel at University College London. And she was working with people with PTSD who, you know, were having these sort of visceral reactions to situations. You know, and she said, well, you can't ignore the fact, you know, that there's all this fear and anxiety and panic that's happening. But that comes along with a racing heart and you know, fast breathing and these kind of tension feelings. So you can't ignore this stuff. So she was one of the people that started looking into this and saying, well, how does the body play into what's happening in the mind?
And as you say, this area is getting a huge amount of research put into it now for perhaps the first time or a deeper level. So what are some of the latest developments?
Yeah, so most of the research that's been done that's had the most evidence so far has been done with anxiety and panic disorders because of this very strong link between what your heart is doing and how you're breathing and feeling anxiety. And so there's something very fundamental about a racing heartbeat that the brain can't immediately explain. And so, you know, if you run up the stairs, you're not going to feel anxious necessarily because you realize you just run up the stairs and your heart's risen. But if that happens and you're not really tuned into that signal, it can spiral anxiety. And so one of the interesting things about it is that Sarah Garfinkel, again, has done some studies, some training studies, where she's taken people with anxiety and trained them to pay more attention to their heart, to be better at perceiving what their heart is doing. And so that's simply raising their heartbeat, doing a little bit of exercise, and then with biofeedback, training them to be more accurate at sensing their heartbeat. And after a short period of training, people didn't qualify for anxiety disorder anymore. And after a year, they were still feeling much better because they could put those signals more into context. But there's much more stuff going on. So people are starting to look at gut sensations now. So as part of my research for the book, I was able to swallow a vibrating capsule, like a battery-powered capsule, that sort of felt like swallowed a tiny phone on but vibrate. And that's to work out how people are able or not able to tune into what's happening in the stomach. And that's relevant to everything from anxiety to feeling full. It's relevant for treating things like anorexia and binge eating disorder. And so looking at how those sensations in the stomach affect the brain is revealing some really interesting potential new treatments for those kinds of things. And also flotation therapy, in which, I don't know if you've ever done it, but you go into a very salty tank with a lid and it's dark and you don't feel anything because you're completely in zero gravity. The water is holding up your body and it's at body temperature. What that does is it kind of takes away all external sources of information. So all your brain can do is go inwards. And so that seems to enhance interoception in ways that seems to help people feel calmer, more in control, and to self-regulate based on their body signals a lot better.
I have done that. And I think I had built it up in my mind to be something that I would feel very claustrophobic within. So because I had negative associations with it, when I arrived to it and saw that the dome was actually quite large and it was very easy to get out at any stage, it's sort of on a hinge, I didn't feel trapped and I really enjoyed it. So I think I was kind of pleasantly surprised throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. And because usually in sort of flotation centres or, you know, spas where these tanks exist now, usually you're in a private room. So if you want to have the lid open, you can. If you want to leave the lights on, you can. And so you can kind of build up to the feeling of being enclosed. But But to really get that sensation of sort of floating in space, you know, you can't feel your body, you can't feel the air around you because it's all kept at sort of body temperature. Being enclosed, I didn't find it claustrophobic at all. In fact, I'm very fidgety. I can't stay still. I'm not very good at just sort of being quiet for any period of time. But every time I've done it, when the music comes on at the end of the hour to say, okay, come back to the world now, I'm always like, oh, really? More? I'm like, it's not boring and it's not claustrophobic. It's amazing. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I loved it. The place I went to actually here in Ireland has since closed down. I don't know if Ireland were ready. I hope we become more ready. But can we talk about when we stop listening to our innate intuitive systems and why? You delve a lot into something you've touched on there, eating to fullness. So our body will tell us we're full now, that's all we need. And yet we'll override it. And you delve into the area of ultra-processed foods and how that has wreaked havoc on this system.
Yeah, so I think the way we eat now, a lot of the ultra-processed foods, you know, they tend to be lower in fibre, they are, you know, higher in sugar, they're easy to kind of just eat mindlessly. So one of the examples that I gave in the book is, do you imagine how easy it is to just eat a packet of crisps? And then not really register that you've eaten that versus if you were to eat a whole potato, a baked potato. So there's roughly the same amount of potato in a bag of crisps as there is in a sort of medium-sized baked potato, but one you can whiz down quickly and not spoil your next meal, but if you ate a potato, you probably know about it. And so the signals that we have that says, okay, that's enough now, probably time to stop, get messed up by these kinds of foods. But there's also the fact of if our attention is elsewhere when we're eating, you know, you don't notice your fullness because maybe you're watching something on the TV or scrolling on your phone or thinking about something that happened today. So I think the foods we eat and the way we eat are not helping us at all. So one thing that might be worth a try is sort of eating more whole foods, maybe just once a week. You know, I'm not saying everyone has to stop eating these lovely crisps and things, but taking a little bit of time to eat slowly and notice those fullness signals and get to know what they are. And then if you get to the point where you still want to eat, then notice what's driving that, because it might be, oh, do you know what, I fancy something sweet as a little treat, and that's fine. But, you know, trying to distinguish between these different sensations and what they mean, I think is really important if we want to sort of get back in touch with what we actually need.
Because when we keep overriding these systems, we not only cut off perhaps uncomfortable feelings, maybe stress, because you also touch on the way in which we live and feeling stress and trying to distract ourselves from that, whether it's through doom scrolling or other unhealthy behaviours. But when we start to do that and distract from the stress, we're also distracting from the pleasure and important messages that we need to receive. And I think that's what people forget.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's very tempting to just kind of think, oh, God, I'm a bit stressed, I'll just do some mindless scrolling. I'm as guilty of that as anybody. And it doesn't necessarily help. But also, if you can feel the connection with other people. So the way we experience empathy and connections with other people, our bodies literally respond to somebody else's feelings. We sort of feel a version of what they're feeling in our own bodies. And if we're not connected into that, we're missing out on this this lovely aspect of life where we can connect to other people and understand them at a deeper level. And also that then has all kinds of effect in that when you have someone you feel safe and, you know, supported by, that affects how urgently your body signals things like anxiety and pain and confidence and all these sort of feelings that come from inside of you. If you have support and can empathize with other people, that benefits everybody. So yeah, I think there's lots of reasons why we wouldn't want to miss out on this information.
Yeah, and I think we can all see that's something that's very much missing in the modern world. Can you tell us as well about body mental health and the experiment you took part in Oklahoma?
So yeah, I mean, I had a great time in Oklahoma. I was invited for 3 days of a full immersion. So it involved flotation tank therapy. That's where I swallowed the vibrating pill to see my stomach. But one of the ones that was really quite surprising to me was one that looked at how the perception of breath moving in and out of your body, how that affects how you feel and also whether you listen to those signals or not. So when it comes to interoception, it's not just a one-way street. So you're not just, the brain isn't there just sort of taking this information. It's also predicting what's likely happening and interpreting things. So there's this whole back and forth going on. And the experiment I did in Tulsa was about changing how difficult it was to breathe, to take a breath in. And breathing, like heart rate, is something that your brain never ignores. If it becomes difficult to breathe, your brain notices and wants to know about it. And so this experiment played with changing how difficult it was to breathe through a tube, and then also timed that with a beep. So I was learning to predict, based on what beep came before the breath, whether it's going to be a hard one or it's going to be an easy one. And over time, I learned that if they played a high-pitched beep, it was going to be a hard breath. If they played a low-pitched beep, it was going to be an easy breath. And so they did a few training things on that. And then they mixed it up without telling me. And the weird thing was that after I'd learned these associations, my brain was remarkably stubborn about, so they played me a high-pitched tune and gave me a difficult breath, I didn't feel it, and vice versa. So based on what my brain was expecting, I sort of made it real in my body. So that's a really interesting thing, because you often think that, okay, you should always trust what your body is saying. You should always take this wisdom from within. Sometimes that doesn't really serve you. And in things like anxiety disorders and addictions and all kinds of mental health issues, sometimes the problem can be that when the body signal changes, the brain is stubborn and sticks to what it learned, perhaps because that was a safe thing to learn at the time. And so this sort of experiment is shedding light on things like PTSD and other problems where people's brains have got stuck in panic mode and don't learn that they are now safe. So that was kind of really interesting. And I didn't realize at the time, it's amazing how I was fooled, not just by the researchers, but by my own brain at the same time.
So interesting. But I suppose the joyful thing about the brain, not that I want to suggest it's easy, but that we have neuroplasticity. So the brain can be changed, and so too can our behaviour. The book is called Inner Sense, How the New Science of Interoception Can Transform Your Health. The author is Caroline Williams. And Caroline, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Right, coming up after the break, performance nutritionist Daniel Davey on how everyone has it in them to live the life.
Shop with Rakuten and you'll get it. What's it? It's the best deal, the highest cash back, the most savings on your shopping. So join Rakuten and start getting cash back at Nike, Expedia, Bloomingdale's, and other stores you love. You can even stack sales on top of cash back. Just start your shopping with Rakuten to save money at over 3,500 stores. Join for free at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
Save big on your next project right now at Menards. From mold and mildew stains and hard-to-stick surfaces, preparing your paint project has never been easier than with Bullseye 123. Zinsser Bullseye 123 Primer is an all-purpose, high-performance, water-based primer for interior and exterior residential, commercial, and industrial applications. Save big on Bullseye 123 Primer. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
An athlete. You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, how do athletes achieve winning performances, individual bests, and perform to the peak of their physical and mental ability? Yes, they have the physical and mental attributes to do it, but they're also surrounded by experts who help them achieve their goals and ambitions. It's almost impossible to do it alone. We can often look at professional athletes and think, they're different from the rest of us, but are they really? Well, performance nutritionist Daniel Davey runs a 5-day event in Portugal to allow people to live like an athlete, and he joins me now. Daniel, you're very welcome.
Always enjoy our conversations. Thank you for having me.
It's been incredible to watch your work over the last year really take a step up, whether it be online, your business. Is there an openness now, do you think, in the health and wellness world to find people who are qualified to give advice, particularly when it comes to nutrition?
No, I don't think so. I think that there are some people, I think there's an increased awareness of integrity, but if you look at the engagement and you look at where people are getting information, I still don't think it ranks high enough as a priority. And I also think what's very problematic is that there's some very, very convincing people online with no nutritional background who are talking about complex nutrition topics in a way that portrays their answers as gospel. And like, that's frustrating. I mean, that's the frustrating part of the whole social media world. It's that, why, I saw some stat recently, why are people on social media? They're on social media to be entertained. And I have to accept that too. If there isn't an engagement element to how I communicate, the eyes drop, and you have to be innovative and creative while staying true to yourself and all that.
And I really noticed you do that. I've really admired it. You had a brilliant post. You were out on a pitch and you were talking about stepping away from competitive or professional sport and what you need to have in place to ensure that you stay fit and mentally strong. And I just thought that was a really brilliant way to do it. And you just gave, you know, three or four key points, all while catching a ball. It was very impressive.
That's a good example. That's a good example that I'm, I feel okay about. And I lived in that world. That's my background. And I know that, for example, the movement aspect and having a ball in my hands changes the context and people are more likely to engage in a message that I really, really care about. And I see it. I mean, I was involved in research that looks at athletes, professional sports people after their careers and the fall off in health. I mean, it's frightening. Even those still engaging in sport, if their lifestyle is not matching the exercise element of what they're doing, it has a limited protective effect. So if you think about the changes in our behaviors and our motivations and our focus, dealing with that transition, no matter what level, and I think that's the point about becoming comfortable. But this is this is something that a junior club player is going through. This is something that somebody who runs marathons, who just moves to 10Ks or whatever it is, that they go through this transition. And everybody is different around this, but if we don't pay attention to this area and refocus to understand the value of these pillars in our health, it has drastic implications for our long-term health.
And that's interesting, because that brings us back to why I wanted to talk to you today and your Live Like an Athlete event. Because yes, there are certain attributes that each professional athlete has, but they also have a team around them. They're not on their own. So when the team falls away, be that the one you shared the pitch with or the back room, it's very hard to do that on your own. Why is that?
Well, there's something I want to address that I think is really, really important. And I'm talking about this a lot. And that is the power of a really good conversation. And I'll never, ever forget talking to one of the Dublin football players. He was injured. And he said to me, when I come to training, I can have a conversation with the backs coach. I can have a conversation with the forwards coach. I can speak to the analyst about the analysis of the game and my game. I can speak to the physio about maybe the injury that I have or the program I need to do at the S&C, the strength and conditioning staff. I can speak to you about nutrition. And there's all of these conversations happening that are about them. This is the point about all of this. The conversation is about you. And I will regularly ask people, how often do you have a conversation with somebody that is entirely about you? Entirely. And it happens very rarely, even within close friend groups. There are times when we have conversations, but they're very limited. And maybe they're at holidays or maybe it's at a wedding. But to have that attention on you in these different areas, that's what helps to create a sense of consistency. But the biggest thing is clarity. You have a clarity on what the priority is under each one of these pillars. And that brings the intent and that brings the focus to these behaviors. And of course, you're part of a team. It's easier to do it. And you have got a bigger picture in, you're a part of something, an organization, a club, a team that wants to win something. So that helps to drive your motivation too.
That's so interesting, isn't it? And it's just that sense of identity as well that we we give ourselves? And, you know, can anybody have the mind of a professional athlete? Is that true?
Well, I took a big deep breath there because I had a really, like, I sometimes when I'm having these type of conversations with other people who care about these type of things, this happens. I can almost feel the emotion coming into me from the experience. But last month we ran this exact concept with a business, a group of leaders in a pioneering business. And I asked each one of them to think about their positions, like professionally, and what leadership meant and what it looked like for them to be leaders. And they talked about the coach and they talked about the accountability and they talked about the standard setting. And I said, well, what about you? What about being a role model in investing in yourself and looking at these areas and these actions as things that allow you to perform? Now, we're talking about people like some of them are on national boards for design and engineering. They'd never thought about it like this. They'd never considered. Some of them hadn't exercised in 2 years because that's not what they thought was a part of their leaderships. Even though they're all leading teams, it was about being on. It was about answering the phone and the emails. So just taking it back to your question, these are exceptional performers. Like, we're talking about people who are making decisions under extraordinary pressure, achieving amazing things in a field within a completely different area to sport. And they all acknowledged that the sustainability of what they were doing within their performance was totally unrealistic unless they did invest in sleep, in a more mindful approach, in their nutrition, in exercise. So the answer is, without question, if you want to be, it's about identifying as a performer. But if you want to do that, what are the things that allow you to do that? We know all the answers, but that's why the identity part is so critical to it.
So what about then the professional athletes who, when the team are gone and they know what it feels like to perform at the top of their game and to feel at their best, and I say this without judgment, why do they let those skills slip away?
I think there's lots of different reasons. I think that when you live and breathe a sport for 10, 15 years, and I think that there's an extra layer within this that's probably not really talked about. And that is the body image component, where you're under the microscope as well. Like, you've got all of the supports around you. You've got the drive of the competition, you know, to be on that team, to be a part of something incredibly successful. But you're also putting on clothing, t-shirts and shorts that are revealing. And I know the most confident, high-performing athletes that are still body conscious, body aware. And I think about stripping all of that away. And then think about the only people who now care, or the only person really that now cares at the highest level about their health or about their body image or their performance is themselves. Nobody is calling them, messaging them, emailing them, sending them schedules. Of course, their family cares about them. But is there somebody tapping them on their shoulder to do that? No. And I think the conversations that I have with so many people is about reinvigorating that purpose. Like, if I think about, where does it start? It starts with, well, what's the most important thing to you? Most people say?
Health.
Children. No, their children.
Their family.
So it will start with that. And then if you think about, how do you want to live with your family? Describe it. And I will give the context of what it felt like to have a dad well into his 60s that was able to manage the sheep, move sheep around, travel, you know, hike up the hill behind the house, no problem, the same way that I could. What that felt like with me, for him to be that energized, was inspiring. And I think about how I want to do that with my family. Well, if I don't address the neck issue that I currently have and the back issue that was a legacy, or my strength, I'm not going to function the way that I want to function down the line. So you're beginning to not being afraid to, geez, we're really getting into it here, Claire, but also not afraid to engage your mortality. you know, and I'm not talking about doing this all the time. My conversations with people are very often, does garlic and ginger work in your stir fry?
<You know>? Not all about death all the
it's
time.
It's not all about mortality, no. But we have to go there at some point to go, what's the deeper meaning of me getting that those sessions done? What's the deeper meaning of spending the extra 10 minutes getting dinner ready in the evening?
I think shifting your mindset, and I'm wondering, is this part of it for some of the professional athletes, that there's a lot of sacrifice comes with working to that level. So it's that mindset shift from thinking it's difficult to be at the top of your game to thinking it's actually a really good thing to be at the top of your game. You know, rather than thinking of negative restriction, hard work, we start to think about feeling at our best, feeling energized, and this is a good thing to do. That became far more motivating to me. That's why diets don't work. That's why people fall off the wagon, because it's too hard. Life is hard enough as it is. So when you stop seeing it as hard, that's when it's a lot more easy to manage.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that there's a word that comes up in every conversation I have, and that is expectation. You cannot expect to look and move and perform like you did. Let's say if we're talking about that sports person at 25 or at 30 with all of those things around you. And it's about reconfiguring your expectations and accepting that's okay that you won't. And aligning a new set of non-negotiables in the way that you live for the reasons that we really care about. But if you set the bar too high and you're constantly, and this is what almost everybody, there's very few people come into me and don't do this. They say, well, when I was 30 and playing rugby, I was 90 kilos. They're 115 kilos now. It's 10 years later and they still have that reference in their mind. And men, women, everybody does it. Everybody talks about the marathon that they ran when they were 24. That's great. And that's well done with that achievement. And we can go back there for evidence that you can do this. But the game has changed. And your expectations need to align to what is realistic.
I could literally talk to you all day. Daniel Davey, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Claire.
To find out more about Daniel's events, and in particular that trip to Portugal, you can go to davynutrition.com. Right, coming up after the break, Dr. Larissa Korda on merging the worlds of complementary and traditional medicine to help with fertility, mind, body and soul. You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, Dr. Larissa Korda is an obstetrician, a gynecologist and a best-selling author of The Conception Plan. She believes in a mind-body holistic approach to well-being and fertility. Combining the best of modern cutting-edge science with the ancient wisdom of complementary practices, addressing the physical, mental and spiritual dimensions of women's health. She regularly appears and advises in the media as an expert in women's health, fertility and pregnancy, and is the resident fertility doctor on ITV's This Morning. We met at the Future Fertility Show in Dublin, and she was also back for the Endometriosis Ireland Congress, so she has much love and connection with her Irish audience too, and I'm delighted to say she joins me on the line now. Larissa, you're very welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and you're so right. I'm just in love with Ireland, so any excuse I get to come, literally, I'm there.
So when did your interest in women's health and fertility begin? When did you want that to be your chosen area of expertise?
So it started, I guess, quite a long time ago. Even when I was still at school, I remember picking up a copy of Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom by Dr. Christian Northrup. And that was a book that was really cutting edge. And it was written back in the late 80s by a female doctor from the States who was really revolutionizing a lot of the medical front. And I remember reading that book when I must have been about 13. And it just really, really resonated with me and spoke to me. Now, my mum is a gynecologist as well. And I, for that reason, as I'm sure many people who have doctors running in the family might relate to, I actually really resisted the urge to be a doctor because I saw how hard she worked and all the long hours and, you know, how much she invested of herself into that job. But, you know, some things are far more powerful than you. And I guess that instinct for wanting to become a doctor was seeded in me as a result of my mum and all she inspired me with. But also reading that book and realizing actually there was so much that I wanted to do to help women, and women in particular, because my roots are former Yugoslavian. So as some of you might remember, back in the 90s, early 90s, former Yugoslavia went through a big war. And I just remember, you know, as a kid watching the consequences of that, in particular on many women and girls. And I really wanted to be able to do my part in the future to help. So I guess becoming a gynecologist really helped to unite so many of these different missions and passions together. And here I am.
And I think what's really interesting about you is this holistic approach that you have, this emotional, spiritual side. I mean, even on your website, I was looking through it ahead of our chat today, and you know, you've got the white coat on, the stethoscope is around your neck, but then you've got a crystal in your hands. And that's not something you often see.
No, it's not, but I think it should be, right? I guess that sort of spiritual, more esoteric side of me, again, started probably fairly early on, you know, watching my grandma and my great aunt, who were, you know, these incredibly strong, independent, wonderful women. They were, you know, my biggest icons. And, you know, they were both very bohemian and incredibly laterally minded. So even growing up as a child, though I was raised in quite a scientific household, I was also raised through a lot of esoteric alternative artistic methods. So to me, it was very natural to combine these two worlds together. I never saw them as polar opposites. And then later on, so around 14 years ago, I went to work and live in Australia, you know, the land of the free and the alternative. And this is really where my kind of spiritual esoteric passion started, in that I really began to get a sense of how important so many of these other alternative, or rather complementary, techniques were. And I started to question why we weren't using them as doctors, why we were purely focusing on what we now call mainstream traditional medicine, whereas actually a lot of these techniques used to be the mainstream traditional medicine. So I decided I'd train in some of those techniques. And this took me down, you know, a really big rabbit hole of exploration and beginning to understand how to really merge and marry these two worlds together into what I've dubbed and called the scientifically spiritual approach, which to many people sounds like a paradox. But actually, I've always felt, and the more research I've done in this and the impact I've seen it have on my clients and patients, that these two worlds are absolutely inextricably linked. And, you know, without science, I don't think, you know, we'd understand spirituality. And the vice versa as well, you know, without spirituality, we can't really understand science. And if you look at some of the greatest scientists in the world, you know, Einstein, Tesla, these were people who were spiritualists. And, you know, they understood the bigger meaning behind life, and they questioned it, and they were curious, and they explored and researched.
And obviously the conversation is beginning to widen, and we talk a lot now about health, mind, body and soul. And we talk about emotional health, and we talk about joy, connection, meaning and purpose, and how important these things are. But until the world is fully ready, I think the best placed person is somebody like yourself, who has a foot in each camp, because it means it can't be ridiculed. But I love what you say. These things aren't polar opposites. They're complementary. How do they play a role when it comes to conception? Because this is a huge time in a person's life.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think conception is, for me, that really unique interface between the spiritual world and the material world, right? So it's bringing something very intangible into human form. And for that reason, to me, you know, all of these methods, including the esoteric spiritual and then the mainstream medical ones, have a place in that. So where I've seen it help so many people is in particular where we have this diagnosis of unexplained infertility, which is over 30% of people. And this is where when you do standard medical tests, apparently no cause is found. But, you know, modern medicine isn't at the moment considering that our tests are very limited and they do nothing to examine some of the deeper roots and causes behind why someone's struggling to conceive. And the way I look at, you know, if someone comes to me and has problems conceiving, is I want to know exactly what's gone on in their life from the time of birth. I want to know all about their birth, what happened during that. I even want to know what's gone on for their mother and their father whilst the mother was pregnant with that person, because all of this is incredibly important. And we know we have so much research at the moment to inform us and tell us that the epigenetic programming which takes place in the womb has massive health consequences for people later on in life, even as children and thereafter into adulthood, including reproductive consequences. So I want to examine all of these details. And then I also want to look at, you know, how you've experienced certain experiences. And this is all about how you've integrated stress and various different adversities in your life. Because again, we know that trauma has a huge impact on health. Again, there's copious evidence out there, so much research. I spoke a lot about this at the Endometriosis Congress. And you know what, Claire, the minute I opened that door onto talking about trauma and the fact that, you know, if you've had earlier childhood trauma of any level of significance, you have an 80% increased risk of having endometriosis. When I explained that to people, oh my goodness, the reaction in the room, it was just incredible. I think first and foremost, because so many women at that point felt incredibly validated and suddenly, you know, had that aha moment of understanding, oh my goodness, you know, that explains some of what I was feeling and experiencing when I was younger and where I might be now. So it's really, really important as a doctor to appreciate that someone's emotional and mental state has a really big impact when it comes to their physical health, because it's literally shaping and molding that entire biological landscape at the epigenetic level. So this is the level that sits above the genes, and it's having a really big impact and consequence in terms of certain conditions expressing, whether that's a disease or whether that's a struggle to become pregnant. And even more than that, the healing that I encourage people to then go through when I provide them with the tools and empower them to be able to do that themselves doesn't just have a positive impact on them, but also on any children that are born. Because we know that, you know, if we've got any unresolved issues regarding our own health, any unresolved emotional and mental issues, our children stand to inherit that, which could later on in their lives express through disease or shortened fertile windows. So, you know, all of these things are interrelated. And, you know, again, when we talk about it, I think we spoke about this at the Future Fertility Show, the impact of doing this work is truly transgenerational, and impact stands to impact at least three further generations down the line. It could possibly be more, but so far research has discovered that it is three generations. So, you know, when we do this work, we're doing it not just for ourselves, but we're doing it for all of the future generations that are yet to come as well. So it's a huge investment, and one that I think is really, really worth focusing on, which is why I talk so much about preconception health and that lead up to becoming pregnant, because it influences the rest of your life, including menopausal health.
And you give lots of examples in your book of couples and individuals you've worked with. The book is The Conception Plan. Can you give the example of the couple you worked with on the show this morning, Catherine and Dan? Because I think it just sort of puts into practice your work.
Yeah, absolutely. So Catherine and Dan were the couple that I helped on this morning. And, you know, they were really incredible. They were very keen and passionate about having their own experience televised in order to help lots of other people. And, you know, what they had was 3 years of struggling to get pregnant. They couldn't get any help on the NHS because, as I'm sure you also have in Ireland, the, you know, the limitations to getting any kind of help are really strict and severe. And they both had issues and problems. You know, Catherine had polycystic ovaries and had a high BMI. And, you know, Dan also had varicose seals, which can affect sperm counts. So they both had very real physical issues that lots of doctors would tell you have a very real impact when it comes to becoming pregnant. However, when they engaged in these pillars of the conception plan, you know, namely sorting out their nutrition, improving their exercise regimes, reducing their toxin exposure, and then really, really importantly, looking at how they were managing stress in terms of previous experiences that they were still assimilating and integrating, and then the relationship they were having with themselves and with one another. All of those things helped to bring about, in quite a short space of time, actually, baby Freddie, who was born almost exactly a year to the date of when we launched the applications. So it was a really, really wonderful moment for them. And, you know, I remember the first time I met baby Freddie, and it was literally like looking at an old soul. I just knew holding him, he was such an evolved baby. He'd been around for quite a long time and was waiting for his time to come. And I think that's a real incredible testament to the parents and what they did and the level of commitment they showed to, you know, adopting these methods and then undergoing that healing process themselves. So, you know, they're an incredible example of what is possible. But yes, I write about other cases in the book as well, including older age parenthood, you know, where lots of people think that, you know, because they're over 35 or even 40, that means they need to have IVF, and it really doesn't. You know, every case is different, and there is so much that we can do to help extend our fertile windows and to look after our eggs and sperm and, you know, increase our own longevity when it comes to the reproductive front. So, yes, Catherine and Dan are a great example that everyone can actually watch, you know, on YouTube and have a look for themselves.
And Larissa, maybe you could take on the campaign to stop calling over the age of 35 a geriatric birth, because I don't think that does anyone any favours. Maybe you could just add that to your superhero mission that you're on. What of the couples or individuals who don't get pregnant, Larissa? How do you navigate your work in this area? Because you can't guarantee 100% success rate, no matter what they take on board.
Absolutely. And the thing is, I'm glad you've asked that question, because it's a really important one. And actually, you know, having a child isn't necessarily the end goal for lots of people who may start out with that. But actually, through the process of their own evolution as their own consciousness changes, they may come to either change their mind about that. Because actually, having children is a lot more ambiguous for many people than we're led to believe. And there are lots of many complex interacting factors that affect that at the emotional and mental level, which is really, really interesting to unpack. But also, you know, it's to do with the level of healing that you're undergoing, which regardless of whether you end up having a biological child or not, stands to have really positive repercussions in your life, just in terms of benefiting your own health. And to be able to sort of what I do with people who, you know, may not reach that sort of goal as they set it out to be at the beginning, is, you know, that there's this whole reframing that takes place. There's a real change in narrative. And one of my patients that I can point to, you know, who went through this process and in the end decided that they actually didn't want to become parents at this point in time. But, you know, we had a really emotional conversation, and you know, what they told me was that first and foremost, they learned to parent themselves, something they'd never done before. And they realized the true value of that. And they were able to really attend to their own wounding patterns and so many issues that, you know, they hadn't really had a chance to process and were manifesting at that physical level. So this, the work that you do engaging in these methods is worthwhile regardless of what that final outcome may be. And as I say, a lot of people sometimes actually change their mind about what that final end goal is, and come to reframe it into something that much better fits their personal evolution and narrative. And that's really what I support people to do, to come into their most aligned selves in terms of being able to make that decision from a level of consciousness that they may not have had before.
And if you're going to embrace those pillars you touched on, your nutrition, your movement, your stress management, your relationships, regardless of the outcome, you're going to have a much more solid foundation to take on whatever the next chapter may be. I feel we've only scratched the surface. We're going to have you back, Larissa. Something that really jumped out at me is what you said about how we can get our health in order ahead of even considering conception. So maybe we'll have you back on that very topic. But people can find out more at theconceptionplan.com. There is a book, The Conception Plan, as well as the online course. And you'll find out all about Larissa and see her in her white coat with her amethyst crystal on her lap. Theconceptionplan.com. Dr. Larissa Korda, I'm so glad our paths crossed. Thank you so much for coming on.
Me too. Thank you so much, Claire. It's been such a pleasure.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan. Rory Galvin was on podcasts and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.